Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Stick a Fork in It, my friends. This is the official podcast of Feeding Tampa Bay.
Yes.
Here to talk all things food and community. What do we got going on today? What's the big hubbub?
You know what's on my mind?
Hmm.
I've always wanted to be a part of a think tank, but I'm not smart enough.
Oh, no.
I don't know.
Is there a high bar for
So entry? Years ago, when I was in the business world, I was at a presentation. And there was a guy that was a member of a think tank, which I didn't know what that was at the time. His name was Watts Wacker.
That's awesome.
Wow.
It is
wow.
an awesome name. And Watts, he is, Wacker. As you would imagine, he had like a big bushy hairdo, a beard. He looked like a surfer dude. He just, if there's a definition, like think of a picture of Watts Wacker, that was this
That's
guy.
That's the guy.
So Watts Wacker described himself as a futurist, which I was fascinated by. Now, this is probably back in about 1999, 98, somewhere in there, maybe even earlier, 97, 96. And so Watts gave a presentation, but they introduced him as a member of a think tank, which I, as I said, I was fascinated by. Now, here's what Watts shared, which was interesting because I still think about this today. He had a whole presentation, but this is what I remember. He shared that in the future, people are going to want to own their images because – when you start seeing pictures and you're in the picture or something you created in the picture, you're going to be able to monetize that.
Stop.
Predicting
right.
NFTs.
Now, at the time, all of us were like, what?
Yeah, right? In the 90s? Oh,
right.
My gosh. You
showed,
were like, what?
He showed a picture of the city of Chicago. And he said it was still the Sears Tower. This is the Sears Tower. Sears needs to copyright their building as an impression so that if somebody ever takes a picture of the city and uses it and makes money off of it, you'll be able to – Sears would conceivably be able to make money. Now, I don't think he was absolutely dead on right, but boy, he was pretty right.
Right. He was
so,
close.
Think tank. Yeah. So that's what this
Where
dude did.
Where is he
did.
Today? I'm curious.
We should Google. If Watts
Use the
Wacker,
Googler.
If
yeah.
you're out there, we'll punch you into the Googler and see where you are. So here's my question for the two of you. If you're going to join a think tank, what kind of think tank would you want to join? Where do you think you would be valuable as a member? Where would you be valuable as a member of a think tank?
Video games.
Ooh.
Good call, right?
Just broadly, that's it.
Right? You'd be thinking about big things, video games, like where they're going, what they're doing.
For sure.
Right?
Yeah.
You find your that's where you'd find your peeps, your people, your peers.
Yeah. That's where that's my tribe.
Okay.
Well, I actually have a little bit of now you've got me thinking, because again, that was not in the notes. He's such a rebel. Backyard farming. I have like a whole bunch of people who follow me that have their backyard farms and go gaga over the pictures
this
that I should have.
This is the think tank you want to join.
I do.
There's a bunch of people that have illegal pets in their backyards.
Mine aren't illegal.
That's why she's in the
I think
tank.
We covered that in another episode.
Ethically, okay, like, let me expand. Backyard farming, but
Are you eating the chickens you raise?
Heck no. Oh. They have names, faces,
even,
personalities. But how to...
Sure
okay,
how
let me expand on
now.
That because he did swerve me on this question. Ethically... having a backyard farm, how you're supposed to treat those farm animals, how you're supposed to respect your neighbors by keeping everything clean. These are conversations I have online with these people that I kind of just naturally fit into. So
it's its own think tank.
There you go.
So I have my think tank. So yours is backyard farming.
Yes.
Yours is video games. Mine's what's wrong with people.
That's a big question.
That's the one I want to join. I want to join a bunch of people where we talk about what is wrong with these people.
Yeah.
I think about
that
traffic
that
every day.
What are these people thinking? That's my think tank. There's my tribe.
That could last forever.
Speaking of think tanks.
Yes. We have a wonderful guest with the Urban Institute.
Big think tank.
Mm-hmm. Big think tank. Alexis Weaver. Welcome. Thank you for taking the time to come in.
Thank you.
You're at the Feeding Tampa Bay for a number of reasons. Yeah. But welcome, welcome.
Right. We'd ask you what think tank you would join, but we already know.
I know. But if you wanted to create one of your own outside of your work, what would it be? I mean, I chose backyard chickens, and you're wondering what the heck this dude's thinking in the car next to you.
You know, I always say this kind of more of a just what do you enjoy doing, right?
Yeah.
I have three kids.
Yeah.
And I made all of their baby food for
wow.
each one of them. Homemade
Ooh.
Completely. And I am not a homemade like
no.
I'm not that kind of person,
now
but
you
I
are.
Am that kind yeah. of person. So I did all the like experimenting with all the different recipes and spices and
things. Oh, I love that.
That's yeah. so just like a random
right.
random thing that yeah. I really enjoyed doing when I had very small children.
That's amazing because even when my children are grown, but even when I had them, there came to a point where there was this, it was mailed to you frozen and they were all organic and like that was like the movement in the 90s that you wanted this organic. I didn't take that step though, but I should have.
I mean, it comes down to it's really easy to throw things in a blender.
Don't give away all the
secrets. It's not as awesome as the Feeding Tampa Bay's culinary arts program.
Yeah. yeah.
You could take a page. Yeah.
So because I make a smoothie every morning, I could feed my kids.
You absolutely could. You absolutely could.
Right? And you just have to have a good taste tester. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about that. Where do you do your best thinking?
This is a PG show.
You know, I actually find I am one of those people that I have a really difficult time turning my brain off, actually.
So all the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd say I'm probably always thinking.
Always. Mm-hmm. Always something's going
it's
on.
Always on. Yeah, always on. When I used to have to commute. I, you know, work remotely now. I would say like in the Atlanta area, you know,
the up to
1 hour commute each way to my work. It was a great time to do some thinking and listening to podcasts
there
and books and just kind
That's
of
one of my things is my car. Thomas, where do you do your best thinking?
Probably I'm a big fan of at the end of the day, putting on some loud music on headphones and working out. So a run or a yeah. lift is where I can kind of make sense of what I have heard over the course of the day or, you know, kind of consider what's on my mind.
Gotcha.
But I learn a lot about what I think, and I would ask you this question. I learn a lot about what I think by talking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'll be saying something and I'll go, oh, that's what I think about it.
Yeah, it just bubbles up.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Definitely a verbal processor.
Mm.
Yeah. I will say, I mean, just to be completely like frank, like I was late diagnosed with ADHD and really like it was so helpful to be able to understand that all of these things that there are challenges and then there are a lot of strengths to it. But it was really helpful to learn that. And
right.
So I agree.
It help you.
A lot of times I have to be talking it out to figure out exactly what
right.
where I want to go with it. So yeah. I understand that.
Yeah.
So we're going to learn more about the Urban Institute, which is where you're from, which is all this thinking talk. But we want to get to know you better. And you and I were talking before the show. You're from the outside of Atlanta, Georgia. I grew up for a number of years in Covington, Georgia. So tell us a little bit about your hometown.
Well, I'm still, you know, the people in Georgia would say, I don't know if they would call it my hometown.
No.
Your current hometown.
It takes a lot to become an official Georgian, I'd say. But yeah, so I live in Tucker, Georgia. Lived there about 13 years now. And on the city council, it's a small, about 38,000 people. I'd say it's a small city. But then in Georgia, it's actually one
yeah,
of the like.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's one of like, I think, like top like 20 largest cities in Georgia. So you have like the very large ones, and then you have another group of them. So,
yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's a great, like just outside, we call it OTP, outside the perimeter.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of has access to a lot of different resources, and but also has a little bit of that small town feel, and
yeah.
it's been around since the as a community since the 1800s.
Wow.
We have
yeah.
like one of those like old school main streets that if you watch any TV right now, you've yeah. probably seen Tucker's Main Street on it, because we yeah. do have a lot of filming
goes mm-hmm. on in Covington and Tucker mm-hmm. and all those outer yeah. communities, because mm-hmm. They want that old school mm-hmm. feel. I learned through looking at your bio that you started or part of your professional history is in the food bank world.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about
that.
Like
you say, once a food banker, always a food banker,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
So I worked at the Atlanta Community Food Bank. I actually started there as I'm sure you remember, Feeding America used to do the Hunger in America
yep,
study, where it was like a census that across the country, they would ask people who were visiting food pantries and soup kitchens, et cetera, sort of why they were there, and really like a deep demographic survey about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually hired to manage Atlanta's Hunger in America study and implement that and do the surveys. So I was the research person at the Atlanta Community Food Bank. I will say now that I work with people who are like formal researchers, I'm definitely like, I don't know if I'm that person. But really like, and through that really began to understand like how important data was and is, to making decisions.
Right.
And then as Atlanta went through one of their strategic planning processes, really because of that engagement with that data, we wanted to go deeper into understanding what would it take, you know, to do the core activities of the food bank.
Right.
But utilize those and understand how we could impact family stability.
Mm.
So not just, you know, meet the current need, but how do we start? And it's, you know, Feeding America for a long time. We've has all the different phrases, ending hunger, shortening the line,
mm-hmm.
but really figuring out how to maximize the effort. And so I spent several years with a couple of colleagues and working with the University of Georgia and Georgia State University to work with food insecure families to design a pantry model
mm-hmm.
Focused on understanding what stability would be. And actually worked with neighbors from the Covington area as
okay.
part of that, all across Metro Atlanta. So we spent a good deal of time hearing from them what their experiences were, like showing them the data from the Hunger in America study and them saying, actually,
right.
So one of the things that, you know, I often say is the transportation trade-off that people have to make is one of the highest ones just across the country. And a lot of times we'll assume, oh, well, that has the most people saying that transportation is one of the trade-offs. When we actually talk to the people who are experiencing food insecurity, they're like, well, yes, I have to deal with that, but if I have to prioritize these trade-offs, the thing I'm going to put my money to first is a roof over my kid's head,
because mm-hmm.
I can't have people take my kids away. So mm-hmm. we use that to, like, really them tell their story about
yeah.
what that
yeah.
data actually means.
But what drew you to this type of career? You know, I yeah. given the multitude of choices you have in a life to do what you want to do with your education and your career, how did you choose this?
So I grew up in Texas. So I will say I am a Texan. Mm-hmm. I grew up in San Antonio. I went to Baylor University for college, and then the University of Texas for grad school. And I will say while I was at Baylor was really when I began to see the opportunity to take the gifts and talents that I have around understanding data. So I was an economics major and an environmental studies major. I was only an economics major because my environmental studies major was too small to be a standalone major.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not meant to be an economist. However, I got really good at explaining economic concepts to people that didn't even want to say the word economics. Mm-hmm. And I took a class called The Economics of Poverty and Discrimination. And I mean, that really did start me on kind of beginning to understand the complex systems that are in place and have been in place for a long time mm-hmm. that put some people at the margins,
right.
A lot of people at the margins to the benefit of others. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that would be like the first place. And then from there, I worked at the Waco Chamber of Commerce for 5 years, and we had a great CEO who saw poverty as an economic development issue. Mm-hmm. And so he allowed me and encouraged me to be involved with the business community and the faith community and nonprofit community. We worked on several different like hunger and poverty initiatives. Yeah.
So I'm intrigued by this idea, and I don't know if it's true to draw a parallel between the two, but you mentioned a few moments ago that you were diagnosed with ADHD, and then you talked about your degrees. Is your diagnosis helpful in understanding complex problems? Is that something you have found? Is that a likely, and so your choice of career also probably at the time had to do something with your ability to synthesize, take in information and synthesize. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because like I said, it's like I am always thinking. I always am right. seeing connections between things. So I'd say that's very true. Mm. Unfortunately, it took me, 20 years of being an adult to
right.
learn that yeah. that was
right. the case. To maximize that.
But yeah.
So how does for where you are now, how does food banking, working in Texas, workforce development lean into your role at the Urban Institute? How does all that experience, because a lot of us come from different areas and had intentions of jobs somewhere else, but end up where we are?
I do think it also, I've always been that person who's like, I could do anything. Mm-hmm. You take those like mm-hmm. aptitude yes. tests and you're like, sure, yeah. I'd be interested in being a truck driver and I'd be interested in
going
being
back
a
to the
teacher.
ADHD.
Right.
I could do all of those things.
And, but I will say, I have always been good at that synthesis and bridging. And now I know, it feels like a new field to me, but maybe that's, again, because I'm not in whatever the Beltway think tank bubble is. Mm-hmm. Research translation, though, is what it's called, right? So when you can
define that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you can take these complex ideas and you have people who are doing the research and getting the data across any field, right? Mm-hmm. You need people who then can translate that
right.
for people to make it usable.
Boy, is yeah. that the definition of the difference between a good teacher and a not good teacher?
Yes.
Right? The teachers you remember are people that maybe the first memory would be somebody that entered into an emotional space with you and as a right. But boy, those people that can explain concepts.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
They are the ones that, right? I'm sure mm-hmm. both of you remember somebody that
oh, yeah.
as a teacher that
oh,
just, yeah. right? I remember a guy named Mr. Blazowski was. I was in maybe my first or second year of high school, and I took he was a sociology professor or teacher, but it's the first time I ever heard anybody kind of describe life from a completely different mm-hmm. standpoint.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My son had a teacher. He struggled terribly with math, and I think he was in the eighth grade, and he played football. And she took the math equations and aligned it with football, and it clicked in his head.
Nice. Yeah.
Like took the time, like you're saying, to go into his mind and explain it. And then it was like that, and he never had a problem again. So thank you for that. I'm looking forward because after we're done recording here, you're going to be talking to us. So now I'm really looking forward to it.
So you're a really good explainer.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. You've been doing it for a few years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we had my master's degrees in community and regional planning. I don't like to say urban planning because it's not just for urban areas. Mm-hmm. But I focused on participatory planning, which is how we have stakeholders engaged in making decisions. And one of the tropes of planning, because it's true, is that oftentimes planners in the past will say, well, if you've done one plan, you've done all the plans. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times there can be a tendency not to go back to the community mm-hmm. and make sure that the plan has enough contextualization right. for them. You know, if you've lived in your neighborhood for 25 years, you have something to offer. And, yes. and what you want for your neighborhood may have a lot of the same things as the neighborhood next to you, but there's some things that have yes. its own unique character, right? And so that has been the through line and the thread through all of the work that I've done is how do you really lean into, decision-making, mm-hmm. community-led decision-making. How do you facilitate those conversations? Mm-hmm. How do you make sure that everybody's voice is heard? Mm-hmm. I really don't like to use the phrase, sometimes you've heard people talk about being like a voice for the voiceless, but everybody mm-hmm. has a voice, just some yeah. of them aren't heard. And so for me, it's around how do you amplify the voices of the unheard? Mm-hmm. And that piece of the Food First Pantry design that we did, we really focused on a lot of times people want to give to seniors and they want to give to kids and they don't want to give to their parents. Mm. And there is this, you know, continual gap when we talk about food insecurity and economic instability, where this ingrained narrative of the deserving poor, for some reason, parents who are working or trying to work don't get the same care and support
right.
that their kids and parents do.
Well, but it's on us to communicate that, right? And we do that. I can see just this little bit of conversation we have, I can understand why this organization, Urban Institute, yeah. aligns with us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Define deserving poor. Mm. That's an interesting phrase you just used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the history of charity mm-hmm. in our country has deep, deep roots in disparities and inequities, right? And so we go back to early concepts of very, very early, like pre-United States, right? If you are successful, you have been blessed, meaning you have done something to deserve the wealth and the success that you have received. And so then, therefore, if you do not have that wealth and you do not have that success, yeah. then you have done something wrong, right? Like
right.
that was some of the yeah. old conceptual times. And so yeah. deserving poor, I think, is really, you know, you could have done something differently mm-hmm. or, you know, you have made a decision, a bad decision that has led to where you are. So you don't deserve to have the help until you can, for example, prove that. Really have that need.
Well, and you know, Shannon and Ever, storytellers at the core of what they do, right? They try and amplify and reflect the stories of those we serve. And I would say for both of you, one of the greatest challenges that we have is reminding people that the folks that we serve, mm-hmm. A, we're privileged to serve, and B, they're deserving of our yes. friendship, love, support, yes. and most notably, dignity. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Something that comes up a lot here is that there's no them, there's only us. And I think that a lot of times the whole conception of being deserving is sort of like a mental self-defense mechanism. People are like, I wouldn't end up there because I would do things differently. And it's like, no, that could be you easily.
Yes.
There's no difference.
Yeah. I think we learned that a little bit more over when COVID yeah. happened. Mm-hmm. You know, people had a sensitivity to it. It yeah. wasn't just the person asking for money or mm-hmm. the people that you heard about that, you know, it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think something that all of us fear and also continue to work against is the prejudice, mm-hmm. longstanding perhaps, mm-hmm. or newfound prejudice against those that we serve. Of all things in the world, I'm reading Arnold Schwarzenegger's biography. I'm a huge Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. I recognize he had a few challenges in his life, as have all of us. Mm-hmm. But I also heard him interviewed on a podcast, and the podcast host said to him, I've heard you say that you do not want to be described as a self-made man. Why not? Because if you read Arnold's story, he came from as humble a background as you could in Austria, you know, very poor upbringing. And he said, so Arnold answered and said, you can call me a bodybuilder. You can call me Mr. America. You can call me Mr. Governor. The one thing you cannot call me is a self-made man, because no one makes themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No
Absolutely.
One. He said, you could look at me and I am arguably a great success story. But that's because I hadn't described any number of people that have come along. I want to read a couple of things to you, okay. And then I'd like to have, and maybe for both of you as well, to reflect on this. So one of the things our leadership team did was we read LBJ's speech about when we voted in the Voting Rights Act. And I want to read a couple of lines. And I would encourage every listener to Google that speech and read it, because it is one of the greatest speeches I've ever read, and it is a treatise on who we are as America, or I think who we want to be as America. And so he says in his speech, I quote, "Our mission is at once the oldest and most basic of this country, to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man," unquote. He goes on to say, quote, "But rarely in any time does an issue lay bare the secret heart of America itself. Rarely are we met with a challenge not to our growth or abundance or our welfare or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nature." I read this quote, these two quotes, because LBJ, right, is the founder of your institute. And it was in a crisis of who we were as a country, who we were as a people, that a lot of the principles that he stood for led to your organization today. So, difficult to ask, but reflect on those statements and how that translates into what the Urban Institute is about.
You know, it was I was excited because I knew I was coming here, and the Atlanta airport has a display, and I was lucky enough to leave out of this gate, that has Martin Luther King Jr.'s suit that he wore to when he met with LBJ. Mm-hmm. And it has a photo, and I took it. I'll show you after this. But, you know, a lot of it reflected that speech, the other voices, right, that were coming in and advocating and talking to him, saying, hey, there are a lot of people who are suffering and who want that same access to the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. He did found the Urban Institute alongside all the initiatives of the War on Poverty, right? Mm-hmm. So we had all of these formal policies that at the time, policymakers believed would make a difference and would address the things that you were talking about. But he wanted an independent organization that could help measure and understand and study if those programs would actually be effective, why they were effective, how they could be changed and adopted and, you know, implemented, and if things weren't working, to do something different. Mm-hmm. And so that really is at the core of Urban's history, is looking at social and economic programs and how effective are they? What's the evidence behind them? Think tank is a really broad term that I don't think anybody really maybe knows the definition mm-hmm. of. But we really focus on building that evidence. And I think, you know, sometimes you may have an ivory tower imagination of people sitting up in a room with big giant, those old school big giant computers, just like making their brains work. I'm really proud. And one of the reasons that I wanted to go to Urban to work at the Research to Action Lab. That's the policy center that I'm in. And that is a big part of Urban's core value, is, again, how do we move from doing the research, having the evidence, but then making sure that we call them change makers. So, you know, sometimes you might say leaders. It doesn't have to be an elected official. It doesn't have to be government. Anybody, you know, the activist in mm-hmm. the neighborhood is a change maker. So how can we take all of this great knowledge mm-hmm. and make sure that people are really able to change their lives and their communities at all levels? And I think it's really a great testament to that initial vision that Lyndon Johnson had mm-hmm. of how we can get a nonpartisan vision, right? Everybody has access to mm-hmm. this but we're going to continue to follow what the evidence tells us, right? What does the data say? What does the research say? What do the people, I mean, we qualitative, you know, community generated data is still data, and it's as valid as plugging five numbers into right. a spreadsheet and coming up with an answer.
So I have a question. You're explaining this approach. Do you have any examples that you can share with us on how that data has impacted and an outcome that has been successful?
So separate from the particular work that I do, which I know we're going to talk about in a minute, one really great recent example, if you have seen any of the national coverage on baby bonds, have you seen any of that?
Yes.
Around basically this idea of like, how do we give investments to children, like to babies, yep. to children when they are born, mm-hmm. These investment accounts that end up like building wealth over time for children, and then they get them, you know, when they go to college or whatever, mm-hmm. it takes the burden off of parents. Multiple states are adopting this. Mm-hmm. I know Maryland, Westmore is very like a big advocate and champion. Cory Booker is a big champion. All of that work, a significant amount of that work is coming out of the Urban Institute.
Gotcha.
So we'll go and be like, hey, we're going to really study this topic and come back to either, you know, sometimes it's government funded, sometimes it's philanthropically mm-hmm. funded or corporations funded, and allows us, and we have a very, we are very, emphasize our research independence. And so a lot of times people will fund something, but we are like, we're going to take that. We're going to, again, follow where the evidence leads. Yes. It may not always be where you want it to land. Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So, you know, it's, I think your question's an interesting one, Shannon. I think also because of the way that we're constructing our strategic yeah. plan. Our vision is flourishing communities today and for generations to come. And then our mission is we build people-focused solutions. And the listeners of a podcast have heard us talk about that before. But that framework mm-hmm. is really what you're talking about, is how do you build a framework where you can put in place a structure in which you build strategies and tactics towards that. And in some ways, the framework that we are familiar with is one that you represent in your upward mobility framework. Maybe talk to people a little bit about what that is, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about our work and what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. Well, it all goes back to that question of the American dream that you were yeah. lifting up, right? So researchers, some at the Urban Institute, some other places, began to look at data. Raj Chetty is another one who's known for this work out of Harvard. But basically, beginning with children of the 70s and 80s and 90s, looks like several of us.
Mm-hmm. You were born in the 60s.
The data and research began to show that it wasn't a given that you would be better off than your parents, right? So in the past, there was sort of this like just assumption of generational mobility that you mm-hmm. that your parents worked hard and that wealth or whatever was generated would be able to benefit you. And, you know, one of the, you asked why I started this work, Waco is a good example of a place that had persistent poverty. So there was all of these really great things happening, but for like decades, regardless of all of the charitable efforts that different individual entities were doing, they were benefiting individual people, but mm-hmm. it wasn't making like a systematic right. change in the poverty right. rate. And so the U.S. Partnership on Mobility from Poverty got together in like 2016 to 2018 to try to answer that question. Like, what does it take to really not just have upward mobility from poverty, but to sustain that, right? How do we really sustain that? And what they went around the country, it was a diverse group of people. So it was the United Domestic Workers Alliance. It was the American Enterprise Institute. It was researchers from multiple different universities and organizations and think tanks. And they studied programs across the country that had been successful at moving their program participants out of poverty. And they said, what are the common factors? And what they found was you need economic success. So you need to have like good paying job. You know, you need to be able to be compensated for your time. But economic success alone wasn't enough. So you also had to have power and autonomy. You needed to be able to make decisions and have choice, and be, you know, empowered both in your personal life, but also in your community and in the policies that shape your life. And that you also had to have dignity and belonging. So you needed to be valued for your contributions in your community, to be seen by your community, and to be, you know, a part of what that means. And we call that the three-part definition of upward mobility from poverty. And so across, that was the big learning from that event.
Yeah. And so, you know, as we have this conversation, I guess what I'd want to make sure that we would make clear is that right now we're having, you know, conversations about wokeness, about equity, about all these different definitions that far too often the discussion has moved into an embracing of terms that achieve a political end. But it's interesting, if you were to reframe everything that the Urban Institute stands for, everything that we stand for, it's basically the opportunity for every human to live a successful, comfortable, yes, peaceful life. And I don't think anybody would ever disagree with that. I don't think anybody on any political spectrum, there's no place that doesn't have an appropriate definition. And so from our point of view, and perhaps what you just described, is building a good community, mm-hmm, as simple as that. It has no other boundary or agenda than making sure that everybody belongs.
Yep.
And I think all of us want to feel that way, right? Everybody, absolutely, wants to feel like you're a part of a community that matters, that the place, you know, you started off by talking about where you lived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you quickly identified that was a place you had lived in your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you found connection in that community. Even when we're talking about the think tanks, you immediately brought up video games because that's your community.
Yes.
I recall you and Jack, mm-hmm, right?
Yes.
One of our former colleagues had a video, right? Everybody wants a community where they belong. And all three of these things, you want to feel like they are a part of it. I want to repeat it again for the listener. One, economic success. Who does not want to be able to take care of their own lives? Number two, power and autonomy. One of the worst feelings in the world is a sense of helplessness or hopelessness, that you don't have the access or resources or ability, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then dignity and belonging. One of the things that we get complimented perhaps on most is that we approach our work with our neighbors as the most important thing we can provide them is not the resource they are getting from us, but it's the dignity of the moment that we share, yeah, with them. And it seems to me that that's emblematic of how you all see the world as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to when you were talking about Arnold and he's not self-made. It's like, right, we've all had somebody and will continue to have somebody that lifts us. And what a privilege it is to be able to be part of that, like you are at your level at the Urban Institute, mm-hmm, and how we are at Feeding Tampa Bay, to be able to step in and be someone that believes in them. Mm-hmm. Right? When you tell a story...
Yeah.
Right? They feel like they're heard and we believe that they can succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So why is the Urban Institute important today? Right? What's, as you all kind of think about LBJ's original vision and where we were headed, where do you all see yourselves today in the system, in the ecosystem of the American dream or the American vision? How do you all define yourselves today? How has that evolved? I just asked you like 8 questions in one question.
I know, right?
But you said you're a complex thinker. We're all,
I know,
linear
but
thinkers
I'm
here. We're just Neanderthal linear thinkers
the
here.
Politician answer of answering the question I want to answer, not the one you ask, right? No.
Space to do both. I think there's space, yeah, to do, you know, both. But we also get, yeah, that how you answer the question can be different in different arenas.
I think for a lot of organizations, you know, in both government, non-government, charitable sectors, we are at a time where we're pivoting and we are facing a lot of challenges that many people weren't expecting, right? We have a significant number of policies and programs and funding that is being cut.
Mm-hmm.
And so how we respond in that moment is something that we are absolutely thinking about. When we think about the evidence that's where we are going back to, right? We are following what we, and people much, much smarter than me, have seen this is what works. One of the things that gives me personally hope and excitement in this particular moment is the number of communities that have already adopted the upward mobility framework, not just that three-part definition, but if you go to our upward-mobility.urban.org website, you can see all of the details.
Yeah,
and all
it's fascinating.
Of the, it's very, very helpful.
Yeah.
But one of the things that came out of this is that there were 24 predictors strongly associated with upward mobility from poverty, because we wanted to be able to measure what we were doing. But also, people in local communities want to know what actions they should take, right? Like, mm-hmm. oh, yes, we do have to like understand that three-part definition, but we also want to know what works, right? Because we should spend our time and resources on the things that work.
Right.
Those remain true regardless of how, if we have access to funding or if there are narratives that that don't align. But looking at things like this, I could use this example, right? Neonatal health. How many babies are being born healthy in our communities are very good predictors of how well we are doing in providing those three-part definitions in our communities, right? Because if we have healthy babies being born, mm-hmm. that means that their moms have access to healthy, nutritious food, access to healthcare, access to education, because they have all of the resources that that others right. have access to.
Right.
And then those babies being born healthy mean that they're going to be more likely to be more successful at school, which means that they're going to be able to have more access to other educational and workforce options, better paying jobs. And then we have, again, like an entire life cycle, right, of yeah. generational beginning to have generational mobility. Yeah. And so those are things that are going to remain true, you know, regardless of.
Right. You know, one of the conversations we continue to try and have with the community, and I just keep thinking this as we're having this discussion, all of us, irrespective of who we vote for, really want the same things.
Yes.
There's not much difference in how we see the world in which we want to exist. Now, the debate gets over what rights certain people should have or not. We'll stay away from that one for just a second. But the reality is everybody wants a healthy and, you know, thoughtful mm-hmm. community. It's just that when we start to use certain language, so we would know and guess that if somebody sees Urban Institute, they immediately get a vision of what that is about and what it's for. The reality is it's about making the community better for everyone.
Yep.
Right. One of my favorite sayings that I quote way too often, but Bruce Springsteen, who I've mentioned many times, says nobody wins unless everybody wins.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately people believe that. I hope that people believe that. We certainly believe that everybody's, as we said, flourishing communities, mm-hmm. right? Not flourishing certain amount of people. I want to read another quote to you. This comes from the Urban Institute. I want to ask your thought about this as well. We, however, can imagine a more optimistic future where today's disruptive forces of change are harnessed to expand opportunities so everyone in this country has a fair shot at achieving their version of the American dream. Is that still true in your mind today?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, there's a lot of different ways to frame it. For me, I am a person of faith, and that also drives a lot of what I do. And the idea of loving your neighbor as yourself is one that drives me. And so there might be a lot of different ways that people look at different situations, but I don't want people to be suffering.
Yeah.
One of the things from my food banking roots with the Food First Pantry, you know, we talk a lot about one of the things that not having access to the food that you need when you need it does, right, is it actually breaks up your ability to engage in community, right? So if I had a colleague who would always talk about, like, think about your favorite memory of food. And she would talk about her mother making her cinnamon toast and tea when she was sick. And think about what happens when, as a parent, you can't, you don't have access to that bread to make your child feel better when they are sick. Or you are a member of a congregation or a community that's doing a neighborhood potluck and you can't bring a dish.
Right.
You don't have to bring a dish, but how many times do you not get to bring a dish, right? So you begin to pull away, like you begin to pull away and lose those threads and lose those connections. So the things that food does, is it enables you to be a part, right? Yeah. To be a part of that community. And I think that's really important that it's solving, for example, giving people food doesn't solve economic stability and it doesn't even solve food insecurity, but it does start to bridge this gap to community, right? That is so important. And as we talked about that belonging piece, and everybody needs to belong, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always say I'm a glass three quarters full person most of the time. It can be hard. My daughter is autistic, and I also, one of the things I do at Urban is I'm program manager for our disability equity policy initiative. And it's only been in the past 25 years that disabled people have had the right not to be institutionalized and to be able to live in their communities, like an official right to not be forcibly put in institutions. And, you know, that is at risk. And it does, you know, worry me as some, again, my daughter has speech challenges and I don't know, you know, she may be living with us for her whole life. We just don't know. But I think the people who know her, and I think this just goes back to dignity, is when you actually, when you're in community with people, you get to know people, right? And so everyone who meets my daughter loves her because she is the most loving, smiling, engaged child, but she just has a hard time talking to people, right?
She exudes.
Yes. And the thing is that all people have that in them, right? And so the more we can be engaging with one another and learning that people are our neighbors, I think it leads to these other, you know, conversations.
For folks that are listening, urban.org is the website to go to. And I think you'd all agree with us that if we want better communities, we need framework to create them. And there's the old saying, what matters, you measure. And then finally, you know, as one of my mentors used to say, and I think of this more often today than I ever have in my life, you're welcome to your opinion, but you're responsible for the facts. And we appreciate the facts.
Yes, we do. Thank you so much for joining us, Alexis.
Thank you.
I've really enjoyed talking to you, and we've got to talk more about Georgia communities. But the important thing is, folks, you need to stay curious. Ask the questions, and be patient and understanding. Mm-hmm. We're all the same and we need the help that we can get.